Well, hello, Mike. Thank you all for coming this morning. My name is John. I'm originally from North Carolina, and I'm currently a PhD student in linguistics here at UH Manoa. So this morning, I'll be talking to y'all about a language documentation project that I just began work on the past year. It's very much in its infancy, and we hope and have plans to see it grow. But the content and the goals of the project thus far really happen to align very well with the themes of this year's ICLDC. Individual and community health and well-being, relationship between land and the people on the land, and how language is related to all these things. So introducing you to the infrastructure of language, I think, has to involve a little bit of introducing you to the place where it's spoken. So this, right, is South America, and the little green dot here in the middle is Paraguay. It's kind of cut in half by the Paraguay River, and everything on the west side of the river is the Chaco. The Chaco is kind of a larger ecoregion that extends into Bolivia and Argentina. It's a flat, semi-arid region with a lot of ecosystem diversity, a lot of plant and animal diversity. In the lower and central Paraguayan Chaco, where it's sort of spoken, it's kind of dominated by this dense shrub layer, a very thorny shrub layer. And when I say thorny, I mean like thorns, really big dagger thorns, seasonal wetlands, seasonal flooding, extreme heat for a lot of the year, so 100 to 110 degrees, that's like 40 degrees Celsius. It can be a difficult place to live, and then that's where people say that openly. The language in Tzotzur is one of six languages spoken in the Inflat and Inflat Nation. In the linguistics literature, this language family is usually referred to as Mascoyan. They're all spoken in this region of Paraguay and the lower Chaco. They're not really related to any other language families in the Chaco, no proven genetic affiliations. Inflat Sur has about 4,000 speakers out of an ethnic population of around 6,000. Compared to other languages in the family, that's actually very high vitality. There's another Inflat Norte related but different language that has about 7,000 speakers. But several of the other languages in the family are very seriously endangered. Within the Sur, intergenerational transmission is variable by community, but in the largest ones, especially the one where this project is based in El Estribo, the name of the community, intergenerational transmission is pretty much universal. All the children grow up speaking Inflat Sur as their first language. All Inflat Sur speakers are at the very least bilingual in Guarani, which is the national language of Paraguay. Older folks, older generations learned Guarani as adults, but the younger generations, kids today, they kind of grow up bilingual from the get-go. Schooling is primarily in Guarani, and kind of in later grades, transitions mostly to Spanish. And the final important point about the communities themselves that will become important later on is that most of them, the actual physical space, physical land they live on, only dates back to about the mid-80s. A brief history of Paraguay and the Chaco, up until the late 1900s, nobody lived in the Chaco except for indigenous people. And the Paraguayan government started in the 1870s, 1880s, started selling off a bunch of land to the English to repay war debts. The English sent English missionaries, Anglican missionaries, that established mission stations. Mid-20th century, you had Mennonites and Paraguayans coming in and establishing the dominant industry today, which is cattle ranching. And so by mid-20th century, pretty much all Inflat people either lived on mission stations, the edges of cattle ranches, or literally on the side of highways. And there was a land campaign by the churches, the Anglican Church and the Mennonites, and some other groups and indigenous people themselves to buy land for community territory for Inflat Sur people. So with my involvement, this land campaign I was talking about in the 1980s that kind of led to the creation of the modern day communities was initiated by Tierra Viva, which is an NGO that works both in land rights and health access in Inflat and Inflat communities. They were my initial contact point in the community, and they introduced me to lots of folks, including these two guys featured in these pictures, who are my main co-collaborators for this project. So this is Cirilo Benitez here on the left, sitting down. He is what in Paraguay they call a health auxiliary for the community. So he's trained in Western medicine and works kind of as a nurse in the community. And this other guy who really is my co-collaborator, co-director on the project is Aníbal López. And he is a school teacher in El Estribo and a Yohosma, which brings me to the title, like halfway into my time, I think. The title of my presentation. A Yohosma is usually translated as a shaman or a curandero, a cure. And these are folks that have responsibility for physical, psychological, spiritual wellness of individuals in the community. They go through this process of nefpongwayam, in which they gain control over objects in the physical world, but especially and primarily medicinal plants. And this control comes in the form of a song that's taught to them at the end of this process by kind of a spirit owner of the plant. And this song is in the language of the plants. We're talking about a lot in the process of planting. But this language of the plants is actually not something that Yohosma themselves want on tape, right? So the language documentation is not on this language. The knowledge that the Yohosma and other types of traditional healers in the community have is something that many community members find it important to document. And so this was the primary initial goal and has been the backbone of the project to date. So this INFA documentation project, it's a collaborative effort to document information about current and historical uses of plants, animals, and land in the Infa Tsotl language. We're producing a linguistically annotated video corpus of knowledgeable community members discussing these issues, things related to food and medicinal plants, on site in bushwalk style videos. Kind of the bushwalk is the term that the people use for this kind of thing. So instead of sitting down and kind of abstractly talking about different plants and their uses, we're walking around in the villages, out into the outer reaches of the community territory, finding plants to talk about and talking about them on camera, right? this project kind of has multiple audiences in mind as a language documentation product and language documentary materials. So one that's really important and that we developed early on was that we want to produce these videos for use in local primary schools. Especially to enhance the representation of the indigenous language in formal education. Like I said, it's mostly in Guarani and later in Spanish, and there's very little representation of the language in the actual school setting, right? But it's also important for my co-collaborators to have materials available to non-indigenous interested parties with which to study and understand the language in use and to understand the culture through the language. And when I say interested parties, I'm not just talking about researchers like linguists, but there's a motivation to in creating these so that people in government institutions can see it as well, right? To have a window into how Infa people live in their territory. So quick, short clip from one of these videos. So yeah, this is kind of the core of the project, right? We're walking around, there's kind of running narrative and discourse about general things that interest, things that you might need to solve. Right here he's talking about times of drought. You need to find plants that can kind of hydrate you and replenish you, even if you don't have access to water. Found one, gives a brief example of what it is, what it's called, how to use it, right? So it's important, I think, to contextualize this project within other types of documentation of knowledge that other people have contributed to, because this is not the first project of this general ilk that's been done, right? The oldest is 1981 Arenas, Ethnobotanica Lingua Mascoy. It's kind of a more traditional ethnobotanical study. It's very good, but almost nobody in these communities knows that it even exists, right? There is a more recent project around 2010-2011 by this Italian group, COPI, called Comer del Monte, that produced two really large books and a couple of films as well, documenting similar topics, right? How people, indigenous people in the Chaco, use different food and medicinal plants, right? And there's really a lot of pride in this particular project. A lot of community members worked on it. It's definitely a real community resource, but the books are almost entirely in Spanish. The only representation of the language itself is just names of plants in the language, right? The film, too, is actually really beautiful. It has much higher production values than I'm capable of producing so far, but it's largely silent. There's a lot of non-talking videos of people gathering honey, fishing, stuff like that, but not actually a lot of input speech, right? And so kind of despite a lot of pride by some community members in work like Comer del Monte, there's a recognition that the audience for the products is largely external, right? Several people told me, you know, we decided to do the books in Spanish and not Guarani because we wanted to sell it in Asunción, in Argentina, in Chile, right? And so the language you use is a key component of the audience for these products, right? You have a history of products from the community information flowing out for external audiences, and more national and international media coming in, right? So creating media in input language is really necessary to kind of combat this, you know, outflow and inflow of external stuff. And especially the way that media representation of different languages, different cultures exists in the classroom setting, right? That said, these books, this Comer del Monte project has been a really useful resource in our own project, in that, you know, people are, my collaborators especially, are familiar with the book, and a lot of times in planning what to go film the next day, we would sit down, read through it, pieces would be explained, and we would say, oh, this is a good thing, we should go film this, we can find this, I know where this is, right? So it's a resource for ideas. It can make coming up with topics, things to go find, much easier. So we wanted to use the resources that already exist. I want to say a little bit about health in infant worldview and thinking about the purpose of these videos beyond just a document of the language. Traditionally, historically, Western medicine and indigenous health practices in the community, they don't butt heads. They really coincide and complement one another. People don't think of them as opposing ways to deal with problems, to deal with health. Indigenous health practices, however, motivate kind of complex and far-reaching social networks in a way that Western medicine doesn't, right? Western medicine is there to treat Western foreign illnesses, you know, especially things like tuberculosis, diabetes. But indigenous health practices using yohosma, using cures, involves, you know, they always work in pairs. So if you want to go to yohosma, you have a problem that they need to help you with, you have to go find them, you have a consultation, talk about who's your family, who do you know, what other secondary yohosma would be necessary to help in this problem, right? Furthermore, you know, access to Western medicine these are poor, very rural communities, and access to that kind of medicine is highly variable, and more often than not, it's very limited, right? Traditional medicine, however, is all around if you know how to use it, right? And more, because of discourses in the schools about health and wellness that kind of avoid talking about indigenous healing practices altogether, younger kids more and more don't know these basic things, right? They don't have this information, and so there's kind of the language is still in strong intergenerational transmission. Some of this cultural stuff, especially as it relates to health and food, is not starting to go away. So we focus on two things, right? Panacte, which are medicinal plants, which can range from things that you would use every day to things that are very highly specialized and dangerous that you wouldn't want to deal with. about people who are really skilled and knowledgeable. And then to, which literally means just what we eat, it means food, but that term is often used, especially in these videos, to differentiate indigenous foods like local fish and game and eels, sweet potatoes, algarobo, in contrast to non-indigenous foods like rice, fry bread, dairy, beef, cookies, which are kind of sources for a lot of diseases, right? They're identified as a source for disease. And so the core kind of narratives and procedural texts from like a linguistic language documentary perspective arise from encountering different types of panakte and ninto out in the community. So just some examples, you know, the emphasis on panakte, medicinal plants, here is mostly on ones that are suitable for non-specialist use, right? We're thinking about an audience of, you know, kids in the school seeing this stuff. So we're going out and finding and talking about medicines for things like stomach aches or cuts, bites, exhaustion, right? Something that you, even as like a five-year-old, should be able to go out and identify and know how to use, right? This example right here, we found this mushroom, this fungus that grows on dead tree branches. And Anibal found it and talked about how women who are breastfeeding, if they're ready to wean their child off of breastfeeding, they can eat this mushroom. It'll turn their breast milk bitter and the baby won't want it anymore. It'll wean them off, right? So very, you know, kind of day-to-day practical things to know. We're not talking about, there are medicinal plants that you can use for things like, you know, cancer, diabetes, serious diseases, but that's not what we're talking about in this documentation, right? It's very much functional day-to-day medicine. Discussions about food includes things like where and how to find wild game or different plants, appropriate and sustainable means of collection. But really, more and more, there's a lot of discussion about food collection and collecting food as a social activity, right? And a social activity that supports healthy relationships, right? So not just, you know, you eat indigenous food, you eat correctly and it'll be good for your health, but maintaining relationships with your family and your larger community is also an important part of maintaining and having good health, right? I think that's a good bridge to the last thing I really want to talk about. I originally planned to talk more about these kind of details of plant information found in the corpus we've got thus far. We have about these Bushwell videos, we've made about 8 hours so far of material that's annotated. But the more time I've spent, you know, especially after the field work I did, working with and going through the corpus we've produced, the more I realized that I'd kind of been thinking about things in too narrow a scope, right? I've been focusing on these little bits of procedural text and information about individual plants, right? And kind of missing the more general, more important thing, right, is that these little bits of information about how to use individual plants or where to find them are strung together by this running discourse, this running talk of their use in the context of land and culture, right? So I use this word, which comes up a lot in this type of talk between talks, in the videos, Apkalwenkia Mekinkasla, which is a great long word that you get in polysynthetic languages. It's really hard to translate into English. Anibal always translated it as either Vivimos acá, we live here, or Territorio, our territory. But literally, kind of piece by piece, it means we go about here using things, right? So living in a place is determined by going around using the land that you have access to, right? So if you go back to what I said earlier about this displacement that happened in the history of these communities, right? Most of these present Inuit sort of communities are fairly, you know, in the long scale of things, they're pretty recent land acquisitions. They're not in traditional Inuit sort of territory. They're significantly farther west. And this Inuit diaspora for a lot of people, and they still feel this today, right, is a dislocation in physical space and in biocultural terms, right? I mean, this is just a brief example. I mean, if you look at rain maps, where they move from to where they are now, they get about a third less rain, right? The types of plants that you encounter are really, you know, there's a significant difference. This is a quote from a health study that was done a couple years ago, a woman saying, you know, in El Estribo, the new community, you don't find all the remedies I used to before. In the old English mission station in Maxlawaya, there's a lot, right? This kind of multi-generational, long-standing information about where to find different things that you would use, different medicinal plants, kind of got lost in the movement, right? So part of, you know, on a practical level, the importance of doing this kind of work is we're covering undeveloped kind of outer reaches of the territories and community lands to provide information on where you can find some of these culturally important resources, right? These medicinal plants, where you can find different kinds of food. I mean, this is just an example. This was about a 3-hour walk, this particular video, away from the actual village itself. Nani Wa found a big chunk of these clams that are used in different types of like cleaning and healing practices for wounds that he didn't even know existed in the territory, right? But more important than that, and this is really my final point, I'll wrap up, is that representations of insects or speakers using the community lands in these culturally specific ways is really an assertion of their indigeneity in a place that still to a lot of people feels a little bit alien, right? And it connects this knowledge of elders and ancestors developed in a slightly different place to the younger native people born and raised in these newer community lands, right? This term gets said a lot in these videos, Mokwancha Kelmope, literally white people can't do this, right? There's an assertion in this kind of running discourse in between this little information about individual plants about the idea that, you know, we as Inuit sort of people, as indigenous people, we own the land because we use it and because we know how to use it, right? And so knowing all these culturally appropriate, culturally specific land management practices, knowing how to access these resources is important not only for the health benefits of using a specific plant or eating right. They're important and they're useful because they assert your identity and your relationship to the land more holistically, right? So very briefly, last thing, you know, the research value of this type of bushwalk video is actually surprisingly underrepresented in language documentation projects. I was hoping to get a little more quantitative data on that, looking through like Delaman archives, and haven't yet, but it's not something that people do a whole lot of. And it's useful for a whole lot of reasons. For one, it gets people talking, right? If you need to record somebody speaking and you're trying to figure out different ways to get people talking authentically and naturally, if you walk around and you're out in open space, there's stimulus, there's something to talk about everywhere, right? You don't have to come up with things for someone to talk about. From a linguistics perspective, it's been extremely useful for discovering things like deictic and temporal information, epistemic information, evidential markers, which for me, especially in kind of grammatical analysis of the language, is really important. And these are things that you can't get authentically and naturally through elicitation. And their appearance in kind of the more standard seated narrative is just fundamentally different, right? It doesn't have the same spatial visual context, right? So I think this is the main point, right, is that this particular subject matter, looking at medicine and food in this particular format, right, actually having videos of getting up and walking around and putting these things that people use in physical space, right, can be used as a means of representing all these relationships between culture and language and health and land, which asserts kind of like a holistic view of community well-being and can kind of tackle a lot of different issues all at once. So, that's all. Thank you.
Elena Benedicto, working in Nicaragua. We have done these walk arounds, mm-hmm. And the good thing that also comes out of it is that you see the ecosystem or the micro ecosystems.
Yeah.
Usually on Western ways of talking about it, you get lists, but you don't get the whole setup.
Yeah,
which is
absolutely.
Very good. A couple of comments and a question. I saw that you use a lang, mm-hmm. that you are only translating it into English.
Yeah.
And that you mentioned that they wanted it also to share with the institutions there,
yeah.
either Guarani or Spanish. How are you going to do that? And how are you going to disseminate the videos within the community? Do they have computers? Do they have TVs? How are you going to do that?
Yeah, so first about the transcription. Yeah, I'm transcribing it in Spanish as well, right? Because these are, we make the videos and then sit and transcribe and translate them together. That's all on tape, right? So this particular document is just the input to English, but yeah, there's Spanish translation going on as well. As far as dissemination, I made copies of a lot of these things just to use in their kind of bare form, just the videos when I was there doing this field work last summer. Some of the communities have electricity and computers and projectors, and they can already use it. I mean, I think the reason that Anibal especially was kind of pointing me to work like this and have this idea of we can use this in the schools is because they already had the infrastructure there in their particular school to do it, right? Disseminating it in some of the other communities, especially places where it maybe is even more important, where there's less intergenerational transmission and the language and some of this cultural information is a little more endangered, is actually maybe harder because, yeah, they don't have electricity in some of the other villages, right? So this is focused primarily on this one village where we've been working so far. But, yeah, dissemination in other ways and figuring out how to make it available to other people that might not even have electricity is, yeah, a big question. It's an important one. But there's enough of the communities that do have that infrastructure to be able to do it that this can be used in lots of different schools. Yeah.
One of the difficulties that we've had is keeping the elders in their language when we're doing projects like this, especially right now we're trying to use our high school students to, you know, in effect do this kind of work. But the elders are used to speaking to those kids who are probably their grandchildren, you know, somebody in their family. They're used to speaking to them in English.
Yeah.
So that to keep the whole project in the language is more difficult. And I just wondered if you had some strategies you were using to enable them to continue to speak in the language.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because that's one of those like problems with doing this that I didn't really have time to address. But it wasn't always easy, hasn't been so far. Anibal particularly had done similar types of video projects before and was kind of like familiar with this, that Kolpe project. He had been in one of their movies, right? But yeah, it's when it's just me and him out filming, and he's talking for the camera, but he's also talking to me, and he wants me to understand it in there, and he switches to Spanish sometimes, right? So, you know, the best that I've been able to do is know enough input to be able to ask questions in input to kind of direct back towards the language. But one thing that I talked about near the end of my trip was that what we should do, because, you know, there is still strong intergenerational transmission, young adults, teenagers speak the language, is to do this like in pairs, right? To have me and the camera going out, but have kind of like an older member of the community going around with a younger member of the community, and kind of having, so that would, you know, not only have more discourse, more dialogue in the videos themselves, but it would, I think solve that issue of keeping people in the language when they're speaking for the camera. Yeah, so that's my thought. I haven't done it yet. I'll let you know how that goes, but
I'm Chief Ron Ignace from the Shuswap Nation in South Central British Columbia. I found the pushback on the Western and the traditional medicines interesting, because in my community and my research, we've been predominantly overrun by Western medicine. So I had to design a strategy of what I call walking on two legs. One is Western medicine or traditional medicines, and with the principle that our traditional knowledge has to be the guide and the oversight on the Western. Now it's bringing our people back around, and I thought that that similarity here was interesting. But one of the things that what concerns me about what seems to be going on down there is the ethical research that's going on. People going in and mining the knowledge of the people. Is there ways that our people are trying to control that or regain control over their traditional knowledge now, you know, especially with the international instruments in place?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't speak to that more broadly. I think in the literature stuff that's like published on that, there's a lot, maybe more in the Amazon than so in the Chaco, right? In the Chaco, you have these ethnobotanical studies that have been done, like I mentioned before, that really, by and large, have a completely external audience, right? Like I said, I think, at least for this project, and this is what I can really speak on, is that the goal was, the word that kept coming up was capacidad, right? That if you focus not on listing all of this kind of isolated information about what individual plants can do, but you situate information about the plants within the larger cultural context and being in the place, and focusing on making sure that kids in the community know this stuff, right? That you're pointing information towards the audience that it should be intended for.
Right. Because the mining in the future is going to be genetics.
Yeah.
Okay, we do have to wrap up, so maybe just this last question. Thanks.
Yeah, I just had a quick question about the connection between the traditional knowledge and scientific knowledge. I'm sure different communities are different in how much they would want the two to be connected. But the community where I work, I think people would like to know, like, what is this plant in Western botanical knowledge, and how does that connect with our traditional knowledge? So have you tried to make a link between the two, or have you found strategies for making that link for the community to benefit from both approaches? Or?
Yeah, I think specifically pertinent to your question, this like link between plant uses and how they're viewed in Western and traditional views, right? Things like that Kopi project do that, right? That's more standard ethnobotany, right? I think this paper talk might have been tagged as ethnobotany, right? We're really not doing an ethnobotany project. It's a language documentation project with some overlap in ethnobotany, right? So that information is, I think, pretty widely available if people want it in the communities because of that particular project, right? That kind of lists out individual plants. This is their Western name, scientific name, stuff like that. They can access that. In my understanding of things, and I don't have the ability to speak fully on the topic, right? But the Western medicine, right, is pills and tests. And so I don't think people, you know, in my experience, have a whole lot of interest in kind of blending what they know about plant medicine with other systems of plant medicine, right? They use both, but only using the Western one for things that they don't have the ability to do in the traditional stuff. So I hope that sort of answers your question. Okay. Cool. Thank you, guys.